We bring you now The Living of These Days, the weekly radio service of the Pilgrim Congregational Church, 2310 East 4th Street in Duluth. Now here's the minister, Dr. Royal F. Shepherd, Jr.
Good morning, and welcome to The Living of These Days. It is only a few days now until the 1st of May, that day when many people celebrate the full bloom of spring. Of course, here along the shores of this icy lake, we have a way to go yet before leaves come out on the trees and the wildflowers appear. But in most parts of the country, the full splendor of spring has come. When I was a child, I had some relatives who lived in the Hudson Valley of New York State. Every year, it was a regular ritual, as faithfully observed as Christmas or Easter, that on May 1st, my aunt would take her children on an expedition to gather wildflowers along a nearby creek. I had the privilege of going on several of those outings, gathering mayflowers, bloodroot, violets, and other things of which I never knew the name. You weren't allowed to pick the flowering dogwood. And so it is that this time of year, I begin to long once again for another of those May Day expeditions. But since in Duluth, the time is not yet ripe, I shall simply share with you a sermon that I call The God of Nature. But before I do that, let's hear from our choir. The sermon that I call The God of Nature is one that I wrote way back in 1959, long before I ever heard of an environmental movement. I'll try to update the sermon a little bit as I go along, but since it is so old, you'll have to excuse some of my sexist pronouns. I take my text from that great Psalm of Nature, 104, the 24th verse. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy creatures. It is unfashionable today to speak about the God of nature. The prophets, we are told, are against it, for they are still making war on the priests of Baal. The God of history is the master of the hour. He will have no truck, it is said, with nature's lord. Satyrs and nymphs, beware, down with holly wreaths and may baskets. Hear the word of the Lord. Well, I would serve no God but the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. He talks, I know, of good and evil. He is not the idol of some lawless fertility cult. He declares his righteous will in the context of human events. And yet, who is to say that this God cannot also speak through lakes and trees, birds and flowers, the telling of truth and harmony? Certainly not I. Before with Moses, I have heard him thunder from the smoky mountain. With Gideon, I have felt him descend with the dew. With Elijah, I have caught his whisper in the wind. With the psalmist, I have found him singing in the grass. With Jesus, I have seen him clothe the wild anemone. It is the same God, I think, who fashioned Adam from the dust. Let me do, then, the unfashionable thing and speak of him, this God of nature. For I feel we need him. We need that wilderness world that this God created and from which we come. We can hear him speaking there when the noise of our human world crowds out his voice. To be sure, we are of nature too. And for that reason, it is somewhat contradictory to speak of our human ways as unnatural or artificial. A skyscraper is no less a work of nature than an anthill. It is wrong to set ourselves apart from the rest of God's creatures as if we belong to some completely different order of creation. But still we are different. God has given us dominion, as the Bible says. And more than that, there is often a strange enmity between us humans and our fellow creatures. We have a way of, to put it very bluntly, of messing things up. A billboard along a highway, the sound of an outdoor motor rising from a lake, the sight of factory smoke against the stars. Such things, though expressions of our nature, seem to defile nature in general. And thus, though it may be contradictory to speak of man, a natural creature, as unnatural or artificial, such words do have meaning. We get the feeling that human civilization is a little out of place in this world. Indeed, it seems out of place with something basic within ourselves. I fancy this is one aspect of our original sin. Instead of living as part of nature, we seem to live against nature. That is why we feel the need to return to nature. Now, I don't mean nature in some abstract or philosophical sense. Rather, I use the word in a very practical, familiar way. I mean the great outdoors, the world of rock and sky, of plant and beast, untouched by human artifice. This world has something to offer us. A family driving 2,000 miles to one of the national parks, an old man feeding pigeons in a city square, a farm boy collecting lightning bugs in a jar. Such is the evidence that nature has something that we need. What are the gifts that we seek from nature? Well, one is health. For many years, Hal Borland brightened the editorial page of the New York Times with his weekly reports of life on his Connecticut farm. His little nature essays nestled alongside weighty commentaries on the international situation like a bird's nest beside a city wall. My father was a city man who claimed he didn't understand things like that, and so he used to cut out these little articles and give them to me. My father claimed he couldn't see the point of being out in the country. Facetiously, one morning he got up and said he couldn't sleep because the birds made so much noise he'd have to go back to town in order to get a good night's rest. But of course, he was only spoofing me, for the fact was he did enjoy these little pieces. And in one of Hal Borland's collection of essays, he describes the healing experience that came to him one March when he returned home after a near fatal illness. To see buds open into new leaves was to see suddenly a marvelous facet of that big miracle which each spring stirs the earth and all things thereon. I saw and felt, and it was like feeling my own strong pulse again, sensing my own growing strength. I was part of some universal magnificence, as I had not been for a long time. Many of us, I think, have found that healing experience in nature. I have known myself that sometimes when I have been severely wounded by some experience, I have immediately got it into my car and driven off to some wild place where I could sort of absorb again the healing strength that came from the land. When God told Adam that he gave him every green thing for food, I think he meant not only nourishment for the body, but medicine for the soul. There is an amazing power in the open air, the green hills, the deep forests, to refresh and to heal. Nature is hale. She is brim full of life. She is forever making all things new. There is power to mend a broken heart, to give peace to jangled nerves, to send the breath of life coursing through the jaded spirit. Nature is the soul's best sanatorium. Or the gift may come in the form of wisdom. It is the wisdom of retreat, not retreat in the sense of a cowardly backtracking, but in the sense of a creative withdrawal. When an artist works, he stands close to his canvas, too close to see it whole. Therefore, every so often, he stands back and looks. He relaxes and sees. That is what can happen when we exchange the haunts of people for those of our fellow creatures. We stand aside and try to see the human picture whole. Here, too, is the wisdom of humility. Nature is big. Nature is manifold. When we live only in the midst of human activities, humanity monopolizes our attention. Our universe becomes human-centered. And so does our religion. Out in the wilds, we learn that there is more than one creature with the breath of life moving about this planet. We shed that conceit which sees the whole world, even God himself, in orbit about our human concerns. I must confess that one of my gripes about much modern theology is that it seems to suggest that God's only interest is in us human beings. Here is the wisdom of nature's own order and plan. We observe her. We learn lessons in life and death, in patience and endurance, in beauty and creativity, above all, perhaps, in simplicity. As Wordsworth said, there is more wisdom in a linnet's song than in all the books. Well, I don't believe we have linnets in Duluth, but we do have purple finches, which come pretty close. When Thoreau took to the woods, not only he, but the whole book-reading world grew wiser. But nature's richest gift is communion with God. Now, that is not to say that God is absent from human society. God speaks through people most eloquently. Indeed, his word became a human being. God's voice is heard along the city streets, inside the factories and the shops. God is with humanity in the midst of humanity's distinctive concerns. And yet, there are in us human beings obstructions to God speaking. Man is a great talker, and sometimes it is hard for God to get in a word edgewise. And thus, like the prophets before us, we go to the wilderness for inspiration. How does God speak to us through nature? To some, God is here mainly as a kind of gigantic inference, a logical inference. When they see a house, they conclude that there must be a builder. And so, when they look at the world around them, they conclude that there must be a creator. Now, that thought is present to the reverent mind, even though it may not afford a rational proof. But God is more to nature than an absentee architect. He is a present reality. He appears not just as an inference, but as a creative spirit speaking through the language of the sense. Nature is sacramental, the outward expression of spiritual power. Just as a musical composition tells us about the inner life of the composer, so the world of nature helps us glimpse the inside of God. And when we live in fellowship with nature and with that spirit which speaks through her, every sound, every sight, every touch brings us into communion with our Maker. Call this mysticism, if you will, call it pantheism. Names cannot destroy the reality that the Spirit of God is present in His world is an experienced truth for millions of people. As such, it can neither be substantiated nor refuted. It can only be enjoyed. Now, if we would receive these spiritual gifts of health, wisdom, and communion, it is important that we approach nature in the right way. For she gives only to those who are receptive and appreciative. It is important, first of all, that we go to nature adoring her for her own sake. Most of our dealings with nature are utilitarian. That is to say, we come to use nature. We come to plant, to reap, to fish, to observe, to kill. These activities are well enough in their way. There's much to be gained by working with nature. We couldn't survive otherwise. Our civilization rests upon the premise that we use nature. But if we would receive nature's deepest gifts, we should come to her without ulterior motives. Why is it that when we enter the woods, we must always take with us a gun, a fishing rod, a camera, a magnifying glass, an axe? Could we not be content just once with just bringing ourselves? Nature grants her most precious favors to those who love her for herself. That is the principle of all true love. Secondly, we need to let nature speak for herself. Let us take her undomesticated. When I first came to the Midwest, I was disappointed to find so little countryside. Things were too cultivated. I have seen more unadulterated wildlife in a Brooklyn alley than on an Iowa farm. Now, admittedly, it's different in Duluth. Duluth is not typically Midwestern in this respect. I suppose it has more in common with the Northwest Territories. Domesticated nature has something to offer too, of course. And yet in such a form, nature does speak more plainly of the artificial than of any purely human creation. Mowing a lawn, I think, is like docking a dog's tail. It is intrinsically in bad taste. To be sure, we must tame nature where we live. We cannot allow brambles to grow 4 feet high in the backyard, nor can we welcome the lynx to our fireside. But if we would discover those gifts that only the wilderness offers, then we must learn to take nature straight. Thirdly, when we go to nature, let us cast aside all prejudices. Let us not speak of dirt and weeds. These are human conventions. Let us speak rather of soil and flowers. When I lived in Sacramento, California, I used to have a portion of my yard rototilled every year, partly for the purposes of having a garden out there, partly to keep down the tall grass, which became a fire hazard in the dry season. But first I would allow this wild grass to grow and to flower. There were 6 or 8 varieties. I never learned their names, I really didn't care. But I would collect samples of each variety in a vase, and then I would bring the vase into the house. And the beauty of that flowering grass was more exquisite and at the same time more rugged than any hothouse orchid. Finally, let us go to nature with unstudied reverence. I say unstudied because sometimes something artificial can invade our devotion here. I think, for example, of those church camps of ours. A cross is always set up precisely where it will spear the sunset. And sometimes it seems to me people gather rather self-consciously, seeking to create an atmosphere. It's almost as if they were saying to one another, well, here we are out in God's world. Let's all be very much impressed. Forced moods destroy the holy. Of all places, the outdoors is the last place where a mood may be pushed. Once again, we need to let nature speak for herself. Only then will God speak through her. We should go to nature reverently, but with a simple, artless frame of mind. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy creatures. That is the wonderful insight that comes to us when we visit nature in the right way, when we come without prejudice or meddling, when we allow her to speak for herself, that God may speak through her. Then all the world turns into a cathedral erected to God's glory, and we ourselves are part of the building. We discover beauty there, and wisdom and health and power. Above all, we meet the spirit of the Creator himself. We discover ourselves as part of a universal order and harmony. We lose that feeling of estrangement that overtakes our civilized pursuits. We fit in. We are one with nature's God. O God, Creator of heaven and earth, enable us to live in unity with all that you have made. Amen.
Thank you.
I should like to close our service today by reading to you a poem by Wendell Berry. It is called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Please join me again next week in this radio service brought to you by Pilgrim Congregational Church. And now may the grace of the world join in you with the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and give you strength for the living of these days.
God of grace and God of glory, on thy people pour thy power. Crown thy ancient church's story, bring her bud to glorious flower. Grant us wisdom, grant us courage, for the facing of this hour. For the facing of this hour.
You have been listening to The Living of These Days, the weekly radio service of the Pilgrim Congregational Church with Dr. Royal F. Shepherd, Jr., Minister. For copies of today's sermon or comments on this program, please contact the Pilgrim Congregational Church, 2310 East 4th Street in Duluth, 55812. And please join us next week at this same time for The Living of These Days.